Welcome back to the Country House podcast with Connor, Jeff and I, today discussing the magnificent Osborne House on the Isle of Wight, overlooking the Solent. And this is a magnificent home. It's Italian palazzo, stunning, not out of place in Italy or a Portuguese city where you see a lot more of these style buildings. And interestingly, I wanted to turn to Connor, you first, because you're an architect. When I was reading about the design and building of this, rather than hiring an architect, Prince Albert, and I should say the famed home, in case you didn't know, of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, Prince Albert hired Thomas Cubitt, who was a builder. And I found that quite interesting because it is a magnificent design, the gardens too. Why might Prince Albert have done that rather than getting one of the many well-known architects of the time to come in?
Well, Prince Albert was truly a Victorian man in the sense that he was an inventor, innovation, and had great ideas. And so by leaning on Thomas Cubitt as a builder rather than an architect, he could lead the design. And to place Osborne House in the minds of our listeners, it is almost yellow, a golden house sitting on a hill overlooking the Solent, surrounded by mature woodland. So you have this almost golden house surrounded by green. And when Prince Albert first visited the site, it reminded him of the Bay of Naples, which he had visited in the 1830s. And there was a house on the site, a Georgian house, but what they created was a family home, first and foremost. So unlike other royal palaces, this was meant to flow and feel internally stately, but it was a place for family, for the kids to grow up in. And to set the stage as to arriving at Osborne House, you enter through, it was on the island, of course, so that adds to the magnificence, having this house on an island off the coast. Approaching from East Cowes up a steep hill, you enter through what appears to be a golden gate. It's a gate lodge of a beige limestone colour, and you enter into a parkland that is akin to the 18th century landscape of trees dispersed amongst parkland setting, and they have beautiful specimens of trees, cedar of Lebanon, perhaps the most stately. And on the final approach then to the house, you glimpse it through the trees, and then it opens into a courtyard, and you're flanked either side by these Italianate, almost palazzo Renaissance buildings. And again, back to the Naples, Prince Albert was trying to recreate and be inspired by what he saw when he was in Naples. And visiting Osborne does make you feel like you're in Italy. The stones, the choice of planting, and if you visit on a summer's day, it does feel as though you've left the British Isles. So into this courtyard, on the right-hand side, you have the servants and state wing, where when ministers or foreign dignitaries came, this is where they were received. But in the center, at its heart, is the family home. And throughout the style of the building, there are small motifs that you would find on a royal building, but not on a country house, such as the shamrocks of Ireland, you have the thistles of Scotland, the rose of England, and they're just scattered in amongst the other ornaments. And when you open into the front door, you're in a small chamber which is designed as though it's a marble setting with scagliola on the walls, but of course it's painted to look like marble, and this is making economies so as to not use marble throughout. But that then brings you into the central hall, which is toplit, skylit, and that is the grand staircase. So this being very much a Palladian style house internally on its floor plan, you have all the main stately rooms around a central core, which is the stair hall lit from above. And as the family would use this, the ground floor, as a place of living throughout the day, on your right-hand side, upon entering, you have the dining room, which then opens into the drawing room. The drawing room's beautiful, with yellow satin curtains and furniture to match. Marble columns, Corinthian capitals, ornate friezes and architraves, which were designed by Albert, and dentelled cornices with all ornament enriched, and it's a delight to the eyes, just a feast to the eyes to visit this room. And there are mirrors everywhere, so you get the appreciation that it's perhaps bigger. And thinking of it as lit by candlelight, the room would have been particularly bright by using these mirrors. Now, around the corner, within, it's all open plan, but each space is divided by columns, a screen of columns. Around the corner, you have the billiard room. And this was also designed by Prince Albert. He was a man of innovation. So throughout the house, there are such as innovations such as the bath tub, which has hot, cold, and waste taps, which was way ahead of its time. And the lantern above the billiard table was oil lit, I believe, originally, and it was on a hinge that could swing, could change the oil without damaging the billiard table. It could swing on a hinge, and you could change the oil and then swing it back over the table. And this was an innovation as well. So a stately house, but a family home.
That's really helpful, Connor. I think touching on the family home thing, but also Albert's involvement, you know, history has shown that Albert and Victoria are both very hands-on parents. And it's interesting, some of the features they included at Osborne, which was their holiday home. It was their summer retreat, where they used it at least three times a year. I think they would always go for Victoria's birthday in May, Albert's birthday in the summer, and then just before Christmas. And what's interesting is a lot of the things that Albert put in for the family. I think apart from some of the trivial facts, like, for example, Osborne was the only place where Victoria and Albert allowed painters and early photographers to capture family life. So they wouldn't allow them at Windsor or at Sandringham or at Buckingham Palace, but they would at Osborne. It was very much, it was the main home. They built Balmoral as well, but it was their holiday home. And Albert and Victoria put in some really interesting things. I think, for example, you talked about the inventions Albert did. I think it was one of the earliest places to have a passenger lift in Osborne House. But also, Albert invented other things. There was an early bathing machine, Queen Victoria's bathing machine, which looked a little bit like a gypsy caravan that would take her down to the beach. And according to a news report at the time when Victoria commissioned it, the Queen's bathing machine was unusually ornate, with a front veranda and curtains which would conceal her until she had entered the water. The interior had a changing room and a plumbed-in water closet. So just one of the many sort of innovative inventions of the Victorian era being sort of utilized by Victoria and Albert at Osborne. But I think my favorite thing that Victoria and Albert built at Osborne, we mentioned this earlier before we started recording this episode, was the Swiss cottage that Albert had relocated piece by piece from Switzerland and rebuilt in the grounds. And it was essentially a Wendy house. It was a house for the children to use, although it was a full chalet, a Swiss chalet. The children were able to use it like children would a Wendy house. They were able to pretend to have it as their own house. And they grew it had its own garden. And each child of Prince Albert and Queen Victoria were given a plot in the vegetable garden where they could grow fruit, vegetables, and flowers, which they would then sell to Albert so that he could teach them basic lessons on economics. So really interesting that it had a fully functioning kitchen. And the other reason why Victoria and Albert introduced their children to this sort of domestic way of life at Swiss Cottage was simply to keep them grounded. You know, Victoria was the most powerful woman, arguably the most powerful person in the world at the height of the British Empire. And yet she wanted her children to know what it was like to cook, to grow things, to tidy their house and do all the sorts of things that they were used to servants doing at other palaces and castles of theirs. I'll tell you one of my other favorite sort of trivial piece of historical information about Osborne is actually that there is a second Osborne house, an identical replica, in the state of Victoria in Australia. The government house in the state of Victoria, where the governor of Victoria would live, was built as a copy, as a replica of Osborne House in 1876 as a tribute to Queen Victoria. So it's worth, for our listeners out there, looking up government house in Victoria, Australia, and you'll see an Italianate palazzo virtually identical to Osborne with the belvederes and the towers, which I think, you know, not only did they name a state after her, but they also built the governor's house to image hers. It shows just how much of an influence Victoria had at the height of the British Empire. And of course, you know, I suppose we'll finish our episode on this, but it's worth just mentioning that Osborne was one of the few houses Victoria continued to visit after Albert died. So everyone knows Victoria became a bit of a recluse after Albert died. She no longer threw big parties. She hated Buckingham Palace. She withdrew primarily to Balmoral, but she would still go to Osborne. And it was, in fact, at Osborne that she died in 1901. So it just shows how much of a cherished family home it was that she would still go there, even though the memory would have brought back painful memories of Prince Albert. She loved that place so much, she continued to go.
Yeah, that's something for me that is the magic of Osborne, is that you look at it and it is stunning and it is striking and it's ornate inside. But it's Albert and Victoria's. It's, you can tell so much that it is their home. It is homely. You know, you go in through elaborate passageways filled with white marble sculptures and paintings, but then you realize that they were of living British and European artists, specifically commissioned by the couple because they loved art. They loved that together. There's a huge amount of family portraits, as you've mentioned, their unique parenting for a monarch. Many of these elaborate rooms looked elaborate, and as Connor talked about the mirrors, they were small in size and cozy. And you look at the billiards room and you think at first glance, wow, but then it was designed the height so that the ladies could play, and it was elaborately painted according to Albert's designs. And then, of course, one of the most intimate parts of the house, Queen Victoria's bedroom. And you see there Prince Albert's little portrait hung above the pillow on his side of the bed for 50 years since he passed. And I believe hung above it is the bag for his watch, even. This was a couple who loved each other, and you can tell that throughout all the house. And I think that's the most wonderful part of it, in spite of all the incredible architecture and design.
It's probably worth also mentioning, you know, Connor talked about some of the architectural features of the interior, and Ben, you talked about some of the pieces. Osborne House housed a collection of pieces that meant a great deal to Queen Victoria. Of course, perhaps one of her greatest prides was being made Empress of India in 1877. She was incredibly proud to be the Empress of India, and therefore Osborne, as their holiday home, is full of mementos from India. So, for example, one interesting fact is actually that is linked to that. There's the Durbar room, Durbar meaning court in Hindi. So they actually had an Indian room, a state room for state functions, the Durbar room. And a little piece of fun information is that the Durbar room was designed by John Lockwood Kipling, who was the father of Rudyard Kipling, the imperial poet. So Rudyard Kipling, who everyone knows, wrote extraordinary books like Jungle Book and poems, yet his father was an architect, and he designed the Durbar Room. So and Osborne had a huge amount of Indian pieces within it. So engraved silver, copper vases, Indian armor. There was even a model of an Indian palace. The Durbar Room has a carpet from Agra, where, of course, the Taj Mahal sits in India. So it really did sort of house a mix of treasures. There would have been English furniture, there would have been Regency furniture, there would have been also, you know, especially because Osborne was financed primarily, privately by Albert and Victoria, but it was financed primarily with the proceeds that came from selling the Royal the Brighton Pavilion. So when Brighton Pavilion, which was that great Indian, ironically, Indian-style Mughal palace in Brighton, which Queen Victoria and Albert sold, it was with the money they made from that sale that primarily financed the building of Osborne House. So it was essentially, we talk about follies in our last episodes, and a folly obviously generally doesn't have a primary purpose. Of course, Osborne House and Brighton Pavilion aren't follies in that they were houses that were lived in. But they are follies in the sense that they are quite whimsical, quite fun, and very different to sort of the architecture of the day. Remembering, of course, that the Victorians were keen on their Gothic architecture. So Renaissance Italianate palazzos weren't big particularly. Arguably, there are a few exceptions. I'm thinking, of course, of Clifden, which is a bit of an Italianate house worked on by Charles Barry. But generally, Osborne has a really cool mix of different furnishings and artworks from so many different periods, but a lot from India. And I think it's probably just worth mentioning at this point, I don't know if anyone has seen, any of our listeners have seen, the film about Abdul Karim, the Munshi, who was one of Queen Victoria's, it's called Victoria and Abdul was the film. It came out in 2017.
Yes.
About Queen Victoria's manservant, Abdul, who was an Indian attendant of Queen Victoria during the last 14 years of her reign. And he spent a lot of time with her at Osborne. And in fact, it was at Osborne that he was given a cottage in the grounds for himself and his family. And he was sort of adopted by Queen Victoria and taken under her wing, much to the chagrin of those around her, including her own son, the future king, who quickly ostracized Abdul after Queen Victoria died. But Abdul would have spent a lot of time at Osborne, and it's nice to think that, you know, he would have felt at home there with all the Indian furnishings around.
Speaking of the Durbar Wing, Jeff, have you seen the peacock piece over the mantle made of plasterwork? It's one of the most amazing piece of plasterwork I've seen. I love it. I was admiring all the photos earlier when preparing for this. People should definitely Google the Durbar Wing if you can't go and visit it in person.
I mean, it's a room. It's interesting. The Victorians loved their use of plasterwork, perhaps even more than the Georgians. And you think, of course, we talked about Castle Ward and Victorian Gothic and how they would use incredibly ornate fan vaulting and all sorts of other things that they would use out of plasterwork. And you see that in the Durbar Wing, which has got incredibly ornate Mughal Indian style plasterwork, including, like you say, this plaster peacock above the mantle and an incredible sort of Mughal medallions embossed on the ceiling and a colonnade with again, Mughal archers.
The Durbar Room is completely a shrine to India. The ceiling has, with the layering of the plasterwork, it has such a great sense of depth. The ceiling looks incredibly heavy, and that's created through the layering of the plasterwork. And it's the room itself, with there's, of course, the throne, which represented the Queen's new position as Empress of India within the room. But the narrow corridor leading from the house to the Durbar Wing has paintings, portraits of Indians that were commissioned by the Queen. The artist a group of artists went around India and created these portraits. So it's a very good insight into India during the 19th century and in terms of clothing and style and culture. But by building that wing, it encloses the entrance courtyard. So without it, you would have an open, there'd be an open view across the grounds, and that's as it would have been right up until that wing was built. But the wing is truly an addition to the house and not a subtraction. But thinking about the house in a whole, what I thought was fascinating when visiting was that I think it was in the nursery, I saw a small model of a castle. And Prince Albert was raised, he grew up in a castle, and he would have grown up around castles. And of course, that is what influenced his design and his love of Balmoral and to build a castle there. But although Osborne House is Italianate, a Renaissance palazzo in style, the placement of the towers and the massing of the building is quite like a castle. And in the nursery, they had a model of a castle that had towers in the same places as Osborne House. So in a way, it was a Gothic, castellated version of Osborne within the nursery. And that probably did come from the 1840s, 1850s. But again, when you step out of the house onto the parterre terrace, the colour of that gold beige colour of stone with the statues, the parterres, the choice of plants, it really does set the scene of you've stepped into Italy. And the view down into the Solent, you might be able to capture a glimpse of the tower in...
The Spinnaker Tower in Portsmouth.
Yes, so from the terrace, you can spot that tower, and there's a lovely fall to the land going down to the beach. And again, beautiful specimens of trees planted by the family throughout the estate, particularly in this area. And just like we had mentioned about the Swiss cottage and teaching the royal children about commerce and the trading of goods and where they come from, the planting of trees, and they also had a fort, I believe, on the estate where they learnt about military maneuvers. And so it was very much a place where the family would teach, Albert would teach the kids about all different aspects of life that they wouldn't otherwise experience, and certainly not as royal children be exposed to. But going down to the beach, back to what we had mentioned previously about the Follies, a lot of the time, Follies are built in locations that are favoured by the family. They like walking to that hilltop, or there's a nice view in this area, so let's build a small Folly in this point. And a small pavilion, an alcove pavilion, was built at the beach, which Queen Victoria spent a lot of time in, writing, drawing, painting. And for all intents and purposes, it is a Folly. It's a very elaborate, beautiful piece of architecture, but it is just a shelter and no bigger than that. And yet it was placed there because it was a favorite spot of the Queen to sit, and here she had a beautiful shelter.
Was this Italian palazzo style at all, you know, was Prince Albert really, we've talked about his other innovations, was he really innovating with the design of this house, or had we seen this elsewhere in Victorian times nearby as well? I mean, the only one I could think of is Deep Dean in Surrey, I know of, but...
Well, Deep Dean was, of course, the house that belonged to the Cubitt family. So Deep Dean was where Lord Ashley,
really, was it?
The Cubitts lived. I think it's fair to say the Victorians generally were very innovative, and those houses that were built during the Victorian period all incorporated the latest technology.
Underfloor heating as well.
And things like underfloor heating. Of course, we know the Romans invented those with their hypocausts back in the day, but things like hot and cold running water, flushing toilets, ensuite bathrooms. I think Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, trialed an early telephone at Osborne House. So yes, they obviously, as the royal family, they were amongst the first to gain access to new technology, but the Victorian era was an era of great innovation. It was the Industrial Revolution. And so I think anyone with money was investing in new technologies. But it's funny you mentioned Deep Dean. I think we should just touch a little bit more on Thomas Kubert, because he is an extraordinary man. And this is partly an architectural podcast. And Thomas Kubert wasn't an architect, but a master builder. But he, of course, worked on another famous royal household after Osborne, which was Buckingham Palace. He built that front facade that is so familiar to us all, although as he built it, it was different to how we see it now. Before Thomas Kubert got his hands on it, Buckingham Palace didn't have a front facade. It was a U shape. It was three sides of a courtyard with Marble Arch, which now, of course, sits in a different part of London up at the end of Oxford Street. Marble Arch being the entrance to the courtyard of Buckingham Palace. Quadrangle. And of course, what's interesting is Buckingham Palace, the rest of Buckingham Palace, apart from the main facade, is built of sandstone, which is a yellowy colored stone. Yet they chose, or Thomas Kubert chose, when he built the facade of Buckingham Palace, facing the Mall, where they would build, of course, the Victoria Memorial Fountain and so forth. He built it in Portland stone, which is a sort of silvery colored limestone. So firstly, it's always interesting for those of our listeners, if you're walking past Buckingham Palace or driving past Buckingham Palace in London, as you go to the end nearest, either end of the front facade, it's quite interesting to look back at Buckingham Palace and see where the yellow sandstone meets the silvery white Portland stone. It looks a bit incongruous. It always frustrates me slightly that the stones don't match. But that's, I guess, part of our history, that we have these houses that have grown and developed organically. But going back to the Kuberts, I'd just like to touch on them a little bit more, because Thomas Kubert was unusual in that he was a builder. He wasn't from the peerage. He wasn't nobility, but he became very dear to Victoria and Albert, in part because they were so happy with what he built at Osborne. So I think when Kubert died, Victoria referred to him as our Kubert, and said of him, he is a better, kinder-hearted man never breathed. He was also known, ironically, as an emperor. He was known as the emperor of the building trade, just as Queen Victoria was the empress of India. So there's a lot of overlap. And it's worth just mentioning that, of course, Thomas Kubert's most famous, if anyone wants to see his works, apart from his work at Buckingham Palace and Osborne, is, of course, it was Thomas Kubert who was commissioned by the Duke of Westminster to build his estates in Belgravia and Pimlico. So all the stucco-fronted terraces and townhouses you see on Belgrave Square and Eaton Square and Chester Square and so forth were all done by Thomas Kubert in the 19th century, the end of the Regency, beginning of the Victorian era.
I was going to say it was the perfect team. They complemented each other so well that Albert had the vision, design, and Kubert had the understanding of what can be built and how it can be built. And walking around Osborne House, thinking, how does this compare to a Georgian country house or something that maybe people be more familiar with when they visit a National Trust property? That Osborne House is a celebration of art and color and material and craftsmanship. The corridors have a richness of color, but also texture in the frames, the cornice, the colors of yellow ochre, burnt umber. You have greens and blues in places you wouldn't expect to see them. In a lot of houses, we often see the ornament, the enrichment to a cornice is elaborated by gold, and we call that gilding. It's a gilt cornice. But here in Osborne, they are finished with blues and reds and colors that we wouldn't expect, perhaps those that we would attribute to depictions of colored temples in ancient Greece. We've often seen Greek temples and we see them as stone, but of course there are recreations of them with color, and I think Osborne House is akin to that. Walking through the corridors, as Ben had mentioned, the statues, each one is as magnificent as the next. It does stop you to pause and contemplate each. And thinking of its use, Queen Victoria walking around these corridors, it's the perfect place to promenade, to walk in conversation, and perhaps stop at one of the many statues or paintings. It lends itself very well to that. But in the main house, standing in that central stair hall, the celebration of material, the marble, real and fake. And what I mean by fake is the scagliola. This is an effect of where an artist will paint a material, paint the plasterwork on the wall to appear as though it's marble with veining and variation in color. And it has a magnificent effect. Now, the effect is given away when you see where there might be a bit of wear and tear on an edge or where people have been brushing up over years. But it lends itself well to this day of that effect, that this is of expensive material. It's showing off the richness of the palette of colors, but also the choice of materials, whether they be painted by an artist or quarried from the earth. We've spoken previously about how the house may be demolished and a new house is built in its place. And for that reason, you'll often find the gate lodge or the stables predate the current country house. And in Osborne, you will see that the stables is part of the original 18th century house. And this was for the obvious, why rebuild a new stables? It was perfectly fine as it was. The old house was demolished and new Osborne house was built as we see it today. But the stables, if you visit, predates the house. And an interesting find is that the original doorway to the 18th century house now stands as the entrance to the walled garden. So they repurposed that. And as we've talked about in the previous Follies podcast episode, repurposing and reusing architectural items, elements from the house or around the estate for new places.
Thanks, Connor. I think I was going to say it's probably worth talking a little bit more about the history of Osborne after Queen Victoria died, because that's sort of the natural conclusion to this episode. Is, you know, it was this love story of Albert and Victoria and their adoration for their children and their love for the Isle of Wight that led them to build the house, but. After Queen Victoria died, with her surrounded by family at Osborne House, her children didn't want it. So interestingly, they went against the wishes of her will. In her will, she left strict instructions that Osborne was to remain in her family. Yet her children weren't interested. Princess Beatrice and Princess Louise were given houses on the estate, but Edward VII, who succeeded Queen Victoria to the throne, presented Osborne to the nation on coronation day in August 1902. So he wasn't interested in maintaining it as a home at all, which is strange when you think that it would have been where he would have had some of his most idyllic childhood experiences. I think when I visited Osborne House and I went to the Swiss cottage, there are rows and rows of little miniature wheelbarrows and spades and hoes that were designed and built specially for the royal children to practice their gardening. So it's quite sad. I'm sure Victoria would have been heartbroken at the thought of Osborne being no longer being used or loved by her family. But of course, it does mean that it can be used and cherished by the nation. It's now overseen by English Heritage. But in the interim, between it being given to the nation in 1902 and it then becoming an English Heritage property, it was used firstly as a Royal Naval College. So in 1903, it became home to the Royal Naval College Osborne, which was essentially where initial training would happen before they went on to the main Royal Naval College in Dartmouth. So for our listeners out there, if you want to become a Royal Naval officer as opposed to a sailor, then you would go to, a bit like if you want to be an army officer rather than a soldier, you go to the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. In the same way, if you want to be a naval officer, you go to the Royal Naval College Dartmouth. But the Royal Naval College Osborne was seen as a precursor to that. So it's where you would go from the age of 13 to train up and study before continuing at Dartmouth. And although the college closed in 1921, interestingly, Queen Victoria's great-grandsons, Edward VIII, who of course abdicated, George VI, our late Queen's father, and George, Duke of Kent, who was their younger brother, they all attended the Royal Naval College, Osborne, as young teens before continuing on to serve in the Royal Navy. So it's lovely to think that they stayed there as apprentice army officers in the same place that their great grandmother had built and designed for their family. And then it became, during, of course, World War One and World War Two, I think, it was used as officers' convalescent. Oh, no, during World War One, it was used as an officers' convalescent home. And it actually continued to house retired officers for some time after that. And then it was only in 1986 that the house was given to English Heritage, or taken over the management of the house, because it was given to the nation, as we know, after Queen Victoria died. The management of the house became under the control of English Heritage, which for our listeners out there is not dissimilar to the National Trust. It's a charitable trust that looks after some of our heritage in the UK. And there are many, particularly interestingly, English Heritage looks after a lot of castles and rather than maybe stately homes. So that's kind of where we got. And I think it's been preserved. It's been kept alive through visitors, and so then it is worth going if you are. The Isle of Wight is a bit of a schlep from London because you have to get the boat across the Solent. There is no bridge for our listeners out there who don't know the UK very well. So, but there is a really good train service from London to Portsmouth, and there's a passenger ferry, a very fast catamaran passenger ferry, or a hovercraft that you can get across the Solent that runs from where the train ends, the terminal station in Portsmouth. There is a catamaran ferry and a hovercraft. So it is worth it. You can do it in a day from London. If you're in London and you want to do a nice day trip across the sea, Osborne House is well worth a visit from that perspective.
Yeah, thank you both. Two really interesting and informative bits of information there. I would implore anyone to familiarize themselves with it. The first time you see it, it's quite breathtaking. It's so stunning. And the Victorian era as well continues to fascinate me. It's cool actually to think, obviously with the royal family visiting there so often, the Isle of Wight was a very popular tourist destination and caused quite heavy traffic on the waters. And just to think of all those people sailing out to get a view of the towers and the picturesque silhouette that it is at Osborne. And also features in a painting that I love, the by Sir Edwin Landseer, you know, the quite haunting one with Victoria on top of a black horse in a black gown, reading a lot of letters. And Osborne is sort of blackened in the back and the weather looks quite stormy. It's amazing. But anyway, thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed this discussion about Osborne House. It really is amazing. And join us for next time, and thank you very much. Goodbye.